Hello everyone. We'll make a start because I've been told that we have to keep to time rigidly all the way through the conference. So without further ado, let's get started on this session with these two gentlemen next to me who are from my old firm, Ross Warner Actuaries. I know Nathan Benares really, really well. And I've just got to meet Richard recently, and he looks as though he knows what he's talking about. So I think you're in for a damn good session. I'm advised to tell you all before any presentation starts that the presenters will be asked to say to think very carefully about how their presentation will make the audience think differently. So there's your challenge, boys. Each of these sessions will run for 50 minutes. For those of you who've been here before, I think you know the drill. There'll be a bell that will go with 5 minutes to go, so if we've got questions going at that time, we may just take one more. Fortunately, we've got lunch after here, so if you wanted to go over time, you're more than welcome, but I'm sure your stomachs will say otherwise. There's also the feedback form that's on your app, so I encourage you to fill that in when the session is finished. The session is being recorded, so when you've got questions, please come up to the microphone, speak clearly, and state who you are if you could. That would be great. Thanks very much. So without further ado, let's get started, and I'll just talk about our two presenters today. Now, they've both given me a bio here, and what they don't know is what I'm going to say in addition to the bio, all right? The bio, the formal bio, Nathan joined Rice Warner in early 2010 and is currently a consultant in the Market Insights team. Nathan is responsible for the production of Rice Warner's superannuation research reports as well as maintaining Rice Warner's industry projection model. As a result, Nathan is actively involved in Rice Warner's public policy submissions, including those for the Financial Systems Inquiry, the Productivity Commission, Treasury and Budget. He qualified as a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia in 2014 and is currently studying a Masters of Business Administration at MGSM. What he hasn't written down here is that he recently started a new career. A couple of months ago, he became a dad for the first time to lovely daughter Alice, and I've seen lots of lovely pictures on Facebook of her. Richard, on my left, as you're looking at me, to your right, Richard joined Rice Warner on a casual basis in June 2015 while putting the final touches on his honours thesis in quantitative risk. He now works in Rice Warner's consulting team, providing analysis on both the super sector and investment markets. In addition, Richard is responsible for producing Rice Warner's proprietary superannuation insights database, which currently contains individualised member records for over 14 million superannuants. He is currently working toward qualifying for fellowship within the Institute of Actuaries, specialising in investments. So there's the introduction. I'll hand over to Nathan to start the ball rolling. He will talk first, then Richard, and then in the traditional way we'll take questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction, Jeff. Good morning, everyone. Unfortunately, I didn't have the forewarning of that information. Otherwise, I would have put up a nice little picture of my baby that you can all look at and coo before we get into the presentation in detail. But unfortunately, you're going to have to do without. Today, we're here. The title of our presentation is Stay or Go. It's the science of departures from superannuation funds. Essentially, what we're looking at today and how we're going to make you think differently is we've taken a large database. I think Jeff mentioned it just then. We've got 14.4 million superannuation individual member records that we're collecting from funds. We've been doing this project for 3 years now. We get the member statement data, and we also get the exits from the fund during the year. So what we've done today is we've done analysis of that data that we collect, and we've applied some kind of new modelling techniques that we've borrowed from the machine learning data mining community, and we've applied that to that data set to see, well, how well can we actually predict which members of a superannuation fund are likely to leave in a given year. So hopefully this will encourage you all to go back home, think a bit differently, and consider some of the models that you might not use in your everyday work as an actuary. All those things you learnt back at uni in your life tables, do something a little different with modelling that you can borrow from someone else. Okay, so today we're going to go through the data, we're going to go through the analysis, then I'm going to hand over to Richard. He's going to show you what modelling we did and what kind of results we were able to get, and then we can have a bit of Q&A and discussion. All right. So for this analysis, we've narrowed down the data set a little bit based on the records for which we had good exit data and continuous exit data. So we're only looking about 5.6 million records. We've got it for June 15, June 14 and June 13. We've got June 16 data currently going into our database, but there's usually a little bit of a lag between the end of the financial year and when the funds are able to provide it. So we've got reasonably large sample, a few more females than males, reasonably good spread of ages. It really just hugs the Australian population curve because it is reasonably representative. Mean age of about 37. And one thing you'll notice here is that the balances are really low. This is something I like to point out, actually, because people always talk about superannuation and average balances, but the median balance is actually under $10,000, which is really, really low. Here's some of the funds that we've included in our analysis. So we've got a good mix. We've got a couple of retail funds, MLC, Colonial First State, providing data, and a large number of industry superannuation funds, Australian Super, Rest, Sun Super, First State Super, MindWealth Wellbeing. So a good distribution of both industry funds, one or two public sector funds. We occasionally get the odd corporate in as well. So I think maybe not in this sample set considered, but in the study generally, we've had the BHP staff fund as well. All right. So, first of all, here is a slide showing us the distribution of members by the reason that they exited, provided to us by the fund. What I'll do is put a quick caveat on that, in that it is provided by the fund, and one-fifth of the time, the reason is unknown. The fund doesn't know why the members left, or at the very least, they've decided not to tell us. So we don't get consistent reporting necessarily from all the funds, even though we ask them to give us the field. They don't always capture all of the different reasons for exit. But well over 40% of the accounts in our sample that are leaving the funds each year are actually rollovers to a competitor or the establishment of an SMSF. And for funds, practically, that's the one they have the biggest ability to probably influence, where they can take behaviours. We're not going to tell you what they should be doing, but these are the people that they should be trying to retain year on year in order to make sure that their fund continues to grow at a faster rate than their competitors. The other big cause other than unknown is obviously retirement, although we see in our sample that actually quite a few members tend to actually take a pension. Not always with the fund in question, but they're often rolloving the money to a competitor and establishing an account-based pension or moving it to an SMSF. But there is definitely an uptick in partial lump sums near retirement. Other reasons, ceasing employment, death benefits, you can't really do much about that. Compassionate or hardship grounds, again, can't do much about that. And then other, which is really just another form of unknown. So perhaps we should have stacked those two on top of each other. All right. This graph might be a little bit hard to read the titles, but here we've taken the distribution of the exits, and the slides will be up online. And we've actually looked at where is the money rolling over to. So all of those rollovers, where are they going? And the interesting thing here is that the results are obviously very different on an assets or membership basis. So the big fear for a lot of superannuation funds is the loss of members to SMSFs. And what we see in this sample is that, you know, about one-fifth of the assets that are rolling over from our sample of funds every year are being used to open an SMSF. However, SMSFs are not the largest destination for rollovers in terms of membership movements. So on this list here, we've got both BT and Colonial First State taking the top two spots for the rollover of exits on a membership basis. Then it's SMSFs, and then it's Australian Super. And Australian Super, of which Jeff is an employee, is the only one that actually cracks above some of the banks, the only industry fund to beat any of the banks in terms of a rollover destination. Okay, so that's a little bit on the sample. Now we'll look at how does the rate of exit vary by demographic factors. And we're going to explore age, gender, balance. First of all, age. So the interesting thing here is that the rate of exit really peaks around age 27. So this is when people are probably, you know, been in their first job for a few years. Maybe some of them are starting their first serious job, and they're looking to really consolidate multiple accounts. There's probably also a few accounts that get caught up here in the kind of lost ATO situation. Maybe you've had a small account with Rest or Host Plus from your uni days. You forgot about it. They lost you. You moved house. They can't contact you, and now your money's being rolled up. But the interesting thing following this is that the rate of exit actually falls pretty steadily all the way until age 50. So we often hear, you know, people make assumptions about behaviour. They say that members will typically engage around age 40 after they've you know, maybe bought their house in their 30s, they've started to have kids, now they're going to start engaging with their super. In this case, maybe they are engaging with their super, but they're certainly not consolidating at the same rate that they did in their 20s. And it's not really until the 50 that members start to leave funds again. And typically that's going to be like a retirement decision. These are all full exits, but if you were to look at partial exits, you'd see the definite same uptick at retirement age and not the uptick at age 27. And then, of course, the distribution peaks around the retirement age of 65. That's when members are often moving to a competitor's account-based pension. Maybe they've sought advice with a financial planner and they've decided to go somewhere else. Maybe they're setting up an SMSF. Gender. So initially we thought there wouldn't really be much difference in gender. We thought exits would typically follow the same gender distribution, but what we see here is that there's a definite increase, relative higher rate of exit for males compared to females in our sample. And the trend by age is very much the same. They don't differ that much. Why? Not really sure. Could be correlated with some of the other variables. Could be that men are more engaged with their super than the females, or more likely to do something during those years that females are taking time off work. One thing that is interesting, though, and it doesn't influence the results too much, is that where funds don't know the gender of the member, especially at younger ages, there's a markedly higher rate of exit in this sample. It's probably due to the accounts being swept up. If you don't know a lot of information about your members, it's probably more likely that you don't know their contact details, they have a low balance, they're not contributing, and they get swept up under the ATO lost superannuation provisions. Tenure. So members who have been with the fund for a reasonably long period of time are more likely to continue to stay with the fund over the next year from our sample. So you can see at the top the exit rate that varies by year. So we've got some bands under 5 years, 5 to 10 years, 10 to 15, all the way up to over 25. And you can see that steadily that rate of exit actually falls based on that. The second graph below shows that the trend is actually the same when you control for age. So we've got four coloured bars. At the top is blue, which is the under 5 years, purple, which is 5 to 15 years, the magenta, which is 10 to 25, and then the green, which is 25 plus. And what we can see is that each line is progressively lower than the previous one. So regardless of the fact that obviously tenure correlates with age, even when you control for age, tenure is still an important predictive factor in showing us what the likelihood of exit is in the next year. All of that disappears once you hit retirement. So there's this obvious clustering at age 65 where everyone just goes to normal. They've all started to look at their super, and it doesn't matter whether you've had that member for 30 years or whether you've had them for 5 years. If they're hitting age 65 and they're about to retire, they're going to reevaluate your fund. And that shows how important it is for superannuation funds to actually be thinking about strategies to retain their members in the lead-up to retirement to make sure that they don't make that decision to switch out. We've also got some account-based indicators, so we'll go through those now. The first one is balance. The interesting thing here is that it's the members with the lowest balances that are likely to disappear. So we've got very high rates of exit for accounts under $2,000. It's about 14%. And that's largely due to ATO loss superannuation provisions, I imagine, because they're getting swept up. And then it starts to fall, but it doesn't really fall and flatten out until you get to the $25,000 mark, which is well above the ATO lost account threshold. So what that shows is that the small accounts are the ones that are more likely to be consolidated into a larger account. And indeed, a lot of funds have already started to introduce tools which allow their members to kind of do this at basically the click of a button, provide consent, give the details, we'll find your lost SEPA for you. So that's a real competitive threat for a lot of funds, especially where their member is not actively contributing. Another interesting thing, we looked at what was the change in balance year on year and then what impact that had on the rate of exit. So we found that largely accounts where the money is going backwards are much more likely to be represented in our exit file. So here we've got the rate of exit by the proportionate change in the balance over the year. So anything that went backwards, we've got a rate of exit of about 10%, but if your account's growing, it's more like 4%. Obviously, there are a number of factors that can affect that. So this probably includes funds where there's been very poor investment performance and people have decided to switch out of the fund following a bad year. This would also capture funds where the accounts are very small and the effect of fees and insurance premiums outweighs the growth in the account due to investments where they're most likely not contributing. So a couple of factors captured in one variable. The next piece of analysis is contributions. So we've looked at what the rate of exit is based on people who are making voluntary contributions versus those who are not. And in this case, for salary sacrifice, those who make contributions are less likely to exit, and those who also make non-concessional contributions are less likely to exit, although the effect is not as different. And Richard will talk a little bit later as to how much this actually has an influence when we come to putting all the models together and whether this is actually important for making a prediction. One interesting effect, though, is that when you start to break it down, you see a little bit of a different behaviour. So in aggregate, we've got lower rates of exits for those making voluntary contributions. But in fact, it's only those who make small contributions who are less likely to exit. Those who are getting up towards the caps are actually more likely to leave the fund over the next year. Maybe that's because they're getting a bit closer to retirement and they're putting money in and then they make that retirement decision and they leave. But we're not 100% sure. And then again, it's much more markedly increased for those making large non-concessional contributions relative to before-tax contributions. Here we're looking at both the decision to opt out of insurance and whether the member has selected something other than the default investment choice on the same graph. So going from left to right, we've got people who have selected the default investment and have insurance cover, then have selected a choice investment and have insurance cover, versus the next one being people who are in the default investment but have no insurance cover, and people who have a choice investment and have no insurance cover. So the interesting thing there is that choice members are actually more likely to leave the fund over the financial year. And also those who have opted out of insurance or do not have cover because it's lapsed for whatever reason are also more likely to leave the fund. And I thought this was a reasonably interesting result because many funds would take the approach that we want to get our members engaged to make sure that they stay with us. The converse of that is that maybe you don't want to engage them too much because then they'll start thinking about their super and realise that you're not a very good fund in the first place. So there's an expression, let sleeping dogs lie, right? Let sleeping dogs lie. When we get onto the modelling, we'll see that this doesn't have as much of a bearing on the ability to predict exits, but it's more likely to be just because typically these are correlated with other variables, so the decision to go in something other than the default option increases as you age, it increases as your balance goes up, and it's generally quite low relative to the decision to stay in the default. So at young ages, you'll have about 90-95% of members in the default option. That will fall to maybe 75% before people get to retirement. All right. So now I'm going to hand over to Richard. He's the bright young spark who's done all of the statistical modelling. And he'll tell you a bit about what we've done and what results we get.
Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you.
So now now informed by this data analysis, we now turn to the modelling, which is kind of the focal point of our paper. When you approach models of these kinds, at least based on the actuarial education that I got back at university, there are two main ways that you'd approach this. The first is a really basic and what I'm going to call the naive estimator, and it's basically just giving all members the same constant proportion of exit rate. So in our sample, it's about 7.5%. It's an intuitively nice idea and very easy to implement, but there are some clear issues, specifically that it's really inefficient with the data. Also, because exit proportions are so low, you'll only end up predicting about 7.5% of the exits, which in practicality terms is not really that strong. As a result, we turn to more complex models, depending on how you define complex, and we start with the GLM approach, which is effectively what we're taught all throughout university. GLMs are nice specifically because they allow you to model binary outcomes, which exits are, either non-exit or exit, with non-normal errors, which also aligns to this exit distribution. But GLMs, as I'm going to show in further slides, are not necessarily that powerful, specifically because they don't harness the data all that strongly. This is especially true in our sample, which is 5.6 million records, and it doesn't really add all that much value. Even when you increase the degree of the polynomial up to ridiculous standards, so 10th degree polynomials on correlated terms, very little benefit. As a result, as Nathan mentioned, we turn to machine learning models from the data science community, which aim at least to implement the data in a far more effective way. So we've considered four of them: support vector machines, XGBoost or extreme gradient boosting, random partitions, and random forest models, which are all generally heralded as far more data efficient. As an extension off the back of these, we'll also consider some ensemble models. Effectively, what an ensemble model is it's just two machine learning models, or at least typically machine learning models, joined together in some optimal way to optimize a parameter. But I'll come back to these a little bit later on. In line with this, we have some prediction metrics that we need to kind of use to evaluate our models. The canonical choice for models of this kind is the log loss. Log loss is good in the sense that all practitioners know or at least vaguely understand log loss, insofar as it's a metric that penalizes for incorrect predictions and penalizes particularly harshly if you make an incorrect prediction on a likely outcome. Unfortunately, though, when you're going to clients who are not necessarily technically trained, if I tell you that your model has a log loss of 3 versus a log loss of 6, they're probably going to expect that I'm speaking Chinese to them, so not all that valuable. As a result, we consider two other metrics, the improvement on the naive, which is effectively the percentage point improvement on the naive model that I mentioned before, and confusion matrices, which, despite the imposing name, are not all that confusing. Rather, they're just a split out of the correct predictions, both exits and non-exits, and the type 1, type 2 errors. And off the back of that, there are a few derivative metrics that you can use. We're only going to consider three because there are many, many derivative metrics you can use. Total accuracy, which is directly linked to the basic improvement estimate. The positive predictive value, which is effectively the proportions of your predictions, positive predictions, that is, that come true. So, for example, if my model says I'm going to get 10,000 exits and I have a PPV of 90%, then I'm going to get 9,000 exits correct. The final metric that we'll use is the true positive rate, which is effectively the number of exits in the sample that we correctly predict. As will become evident a little bit later on, these metrics don't necessarily move together as much as we'd like them to, so there's a trade-off that you have to make. So enough of setting the scenes, let's get into the data analysis. Everyone can breathe a sigh of relief because all of the models actually improve on the non-data centric, or at least the non-tailored model. What might be slightly surprising to everyone is that, as I noted before, the GLM doesn't really add all that much value. The log loss is only slightly lower than that of the native estimator, despite the massive amount of data that it's been fed. Slightly more encouragingly, the trend heads downwards as you go into the machine learning models, and that kind of peaks with the random forest model, which is about half the log loss of that of the GLM or the basic estimator. But again, as I noted before, this doesn't necessarily have a tangible value, so we're going to have a look at another metric for that. This graph effectively graphs the improvement on the native estimator and comfortingly gives the same kind of reflection as the log loss. It's just expressed in a different way. You see here that the GLM estimate barely improves anything. Specifically, it's a 57 basis point improvement on the naive estimate, which really doesn't instill me with confidence. This increases with the machine learning models up to almost 8% for the random forest, which at the point I need to pause and say, well, you've been sitting here for 35 minutes, give or take, and I'm telling you we're getting an 8% improvement. That doesn't seem on face value to be all that inspiring. But it's important to appreciate that despite how much I'm critiquing the naive estimate, it actually gets a decent error rate. Specifically, it's about 86% accurate, and this is driven by the fact that exits is such a low probability event. Because the naive estimate predicts 92.5% of members will remain, and there are so many remaining members, it inherently gets a few of them correct. And because it gets so many correct, it has a decent error rate. So because it has a decent error rate, an 8% improvement on this is actually quite strong, given the theoretical maximum is obviously 100%. So when you factor in the 8% improvement, the random forest effectively ends up with a 92% accuracy. So it's bridged half the gap between the basic estimator that doesn't do very much and the theoretical maximum. And that at least gives me a little bit of confidence. So we now turn to the confusion matrices. As I mentioned before, the confusion matrices total accuracy stats move roughly in line or directly in line with that of the last two predictions. So I'm not going to talk too much to them. But comfortingly, you can see that the 86% and the 92% that I've been referencing previously. What's slightly more interesting, perhaps, on this slide is the positive predictive value and the true positive rate. You can see that while the basic estimator and the GLM get, as you'd expect, fairly low results, between the machine learning models, there's a significant disparity in terms of how they perform. Yes, they're both getting more accurate as you move along the curve, but, for example, the XGBoost model gets a massive value of PPV, but it doesn't do so well in terms of the true error rate. This is driven largely because the XGBoost model doesn't actually make that many predictions. But when it does make a prediction, the prediction is pretty good, at least relative to all of the other models. And this is where the kink to the ensemble modelling comes in. Specifically, by moving the models together, so considering both the XGBoost model and the random forest and putting them together, the aim is that they will diversify the risk or the errors between the model and thereby give a better prediction. This is what you see in the last two columns of the graph, and we've got two ensemble models for you to look at. The first one, ensemble PPV, is basically an ensemble model that's been tailored and optimized, so it gives the maximum value of PPV. The second model is the model that is optimized to get the optimal number of exits. And then this is a decision you need to make as a firm or as a modeler as to which you actually care about the most. We'll come back to...
What does that mean practically? You're a marketer sitting at the desk and you're running your campaign.
So practically, in terms of your marketing budget, you've got a fixed marketing budget, and as much as you'd like to approach every member in your fund and try and remain, you can't practically approach every single person. So you need to make a decision on who you approach. And this is different in terms of what metric you want to use. So we've now been, I suppose, empowered with all of the models, and we understand the data. But of the predictors that Nathan spoke about, which are the most important? And to answer this question, we turn to a appropriately named importance plot. Now, the importance plot, and I apologize for it not being very clear on the slides, is effectively a derivative off the XG Boost model and the Random Forest model. And they both comfortingly provide similar results. And it effectively plots the relative importance of the predictors that we funnel into the model. As you might expect, age, balance, and tenure are all really strong predictors, and those are the three kind of leading bars on the chart. What is perhaps not so obvious, but more interesting, or at least equally interesting, is what is not a leading predictor. Despite the fact that we said that men are 26% more likely to leave a fund than women, it's not a leading predictor on the chart. And as Nathan noted, this might be as a result of, say, other predictors that are flowing through to the gender effect. And so this was a metric, at least when I was doing the model, that really surprised me. Also, what's not necessarily a large predictor is whether or not a member makes an investment choice or has cover. This may be as a result of the data, but it also may be as a result of other factors coming into these predictors. So this is an area that I'm doing a little bit more research on. So armed with this understanding, we then move to developing a final model. And as I mentioned before, the final model for you is, unfortunately, as much as I'd like to give you a one-size-fits-all answer, dependent on what you're using the model for. For example, an academic is going to just want the best model that they can possibly get. What's the model that predicts the correct number of exits and the correct number of remains? But as Nathan noted with me before, this is not necessarily the metric that a marketing team would want to use. As a consultancy, and in terms of people that we normally go out and speak, we've chosen the PPV metric as the metric of our choice. And as a result, we chose the ensemble model that's fit to PPV. I would note at this point that we've maximised total PPV, but you could easily optimise a metric that wasn't total and rather tailored to your fund's needs. I suppose the most interesting feature here, for me at least, is the high level of PPV you can get, 52%. This signifies that if you go out and you approach everyone that the model says, 52% of those people are going to be people who would have left your fund. So if your marketing campaign is directed and appropriately managed, that's a significant benefit to the fund, especially when you consider that if you made a non-data-driven, non-individualized response, you would have only got 7.5%. So it's about a 14-fold increase, which is a massive deal, at least in my eyes. It is worth noting, although disappointingly, that in optimising the PPV value, you do have to let go of a few exits that you predict that would have exited otherwise. And this is reflected in the true error rate moving down slightly. This is all part of the ensemble modelling and the trade-off that you need to make. Just before I move on, actually, it's important to appreciate that while I'm talking about the trade-off for accuracy and high-level accuracy is not actually that bad. The optimised PPV model actually gets a total level of accuracy that's roughly or almost perfectly in line with all of the other optimal machine learning models, which is kind of reassuring. So we've spoken about this model, and we've spoken about all the ways we got there, but what's the practical value? As we've alluded to consistently throughout the presentation, the first one is obvious. It empowers marketing teams and superannuation funds to really understand their membership, to go out to their membership and make a proposition to remain in the fund, whereas they may not have in the past. It allows you to use your marketing budgets far more efficiently, or at least we hope so, to get better outcomes for your fund. What might be slightly less obvious is the value of the analysis of the data. The age-old adage comes true. What you know, you can measure. What you measure, you can optimize. And what you can optimize, you can definitely improve. By understanding the groups in which your fund is losing members, you can identify trends that might be correlated with weaknesses in your fund. For example, if relatively you're losing more younger members than any other fund, then that might be an indicator that you need to have more features for younger members. You can improve it and therefore get better outcomes. Now, it hurts me to admit this, but every model is flawed and there isn't perfection in any model. And this is very true in this case. Exits are, by definition, a very behavioural response. For example, one potential reason that you might leave a fund is because your uncle came up to you at the family barbecue and said that your super fund is not doing a good job, that you should consider an SMSF. As a result, you might move, and there's no way we can feasibly model this. On a similar vein, there are data items that we didn't have access to through the Superannuation Insights study, and we're looking at getting those to improve the model further. But in all, despite the fact that we can't ever really theoretically hit that 100% accuracy rate, the model does really give a benefit in terms of the fund's membership and targeting them. So, to draw it all together, in terms of the theme of the conference, as an actuary who's just finished his university studies that really focused hard on GLMs and basic estimators, this has made me really think differently about how I approach modelling. Because when I go to model my next data set, my first thought isn't going to be, let me pull out my binomial log link model. It'll be, what data-driven machine learning model can I pull out to get a better outcome? Thank you for listening to our presentation.
Thanks, Nathan, and thanks, Richard. I've just been taking a time check, and I think we're supposed to be finished at 12:45, so I've only got about 10 minutes left. So why don't we just dive straight in with any questions. Has anyone got any questions from the floor and can approach the microphone? And please, go for it. And just state your name clearly at the microphone and where you're from. Thanks.
Sorry, so this is Alex from Clayville. So I just want to have a question. Like, is there any study that, I guess this is more like a question to Nathan. Is there any study that would have suggested that the price of the insurance products embedded in the same scheme would have any impact on the exit rate? Like, have you ever thought about, actually have conducted any study that would, or seen any study that would have suggested this sort of thing?
I imagine, we haven't looked specifically at price, but I would imagine that it doesn't have much predictive value for a couple of reasons. Firstly, whether or not they had cover did not have much predictive value, and a decision to opt out may be partially based on price. Secondly, because the majority of members take the default insurance option. And if you've got the majority in the default, I think they're not really looking at their insurance cover, and it's not going to influence the rate of exit hugely. One thing we did know, obviously, is that if the account is going backwards, as we observed, that does influence the exit rate. So it is possible that, you know, if you're paying expensive premiums and you're not putting a lot in contributions and your account's being eroded, that might drive the decision. But I think it would be hard to prove that relative price differences in insurance has a huge impact on the rate of exit.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that's because funds, they would like to retain the clients with higher balance, and normally those are the people with the higher age, and therefore if the funds would like to retain those clients, they may be offering a better insurance price to those clients in order to retain them. So
yeah, of course, it's possible. It'd be hard to measure, I think.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Douglas Isles from Platinum Asset Management. I was interested, when you said balance was the strongest predictor, and it looks like it's obviously negatively correlated, so you're predicting the smaller balances to leave more often. Did you do any sort of extension work on perhaps the economic value of the model, and to the extent that you could predict 100,000 plus or 300,000 plus or whatever, what the accuracy was over the more profitable customer base?
No, we haven't, but that's a definite extension. And that's one of the values of this type of modelling. So I think, you know, part of what Richard was saying was that we obviously want to optimise whatever the marketing spend is. So at the moment you can say, all right, well, I want to make sure that of the people I approach, because it costs me money to approach each one of them, I want to minimise the amount I get wrong. Definitely extending the model to put a value on the member based on their balance and maybe the number of years they might have in the fund, kind of getting like an NPV table per member based on age or something like that, and then multiplying that out might give you a different answer in terms of who you approach for. And that's where it comes really to the practical application of these models. At this stage, for the purposes of this conference, it's a little bit more academic, but then, yeah, when we go out and eventually take this to market, which is what we plan to do, we would be looking more at that kind of commercial basis.
Can I make a comment too on that? Because we certainly, at Australian Super, we haven't done the sort of work that these guys have done. But with account balance, yes, we have high exits from low account balance members, and they tend to be because Australian Super at the moment is one of those industry funds that gets a lot of members in through awards, which may change in the future. So that's the first comment to make. The other comment I wanted to make too, just looking at your analysis on tenure, we've looked at our tenure going down to actual years, and we find there's a big peak in year one, and that's because of people who've come in through awards, members have come in through awards. There's also a bit of a hump between years 5 and 8 in our fund, and it's led us to believe that there's two things. There's the member that's coming through awards, maybe they need some sort of, and we're always thinking of practical solutions to these things as well. Maybe that's pointing to we need to have a better way of welcoming members to the fund. And when it gets to years 5 and 8, and this is just a hypothesis, that's when members change jobs a lot. So should we be offering a free financial health check? Should funds offer a free financial health check at year 5 to try and stop that sort of thing happening? So I'm taking this conversation a bit further from what Nathan and Richard are talking about, because we're also thinking of practical ways to approach what comes out of this stuff. Any more questions from the floor?
So I have a quick question regarding your predictive models.
Sorry, can you just say your name and where you're from?
My name is Jin. I'm from UTS. I'm studying quantitative finance. I have a quick question about your statistical model for predictions, especially those performance measures you presented, 60% or 95% or anything like that. Are these in-sample or out-of-sample predictions?
Out-of-sample. So we divided the sample into a test and a training set. So we fit it on a training set, and then we tested it on a test set.
How large is the training set and how large is the test set?
So the training set was 90%, so of the 5.6 million records, math in my head, about 5 million, and yeah.
So most of the data were used for training?
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Sorry, one point. So we did vary the proportions that we use, and we didn't see that much variation. So because the data... So we didn't do too much sensitivity analysis around the parameter in which we split the data by, but we found that because of the high volume of data that we were training it on, variations on the parameter didn't make a significant difference on the results that we got.
Okay, have we got anyone else? Well, I'll ask one last question in that case, seeing as I've heard the bell go. You can determine which one of you two want to answer this question. So my answer, and I'll go back to practicalities again, which funds do you think will benefit the most from this analysis, of this kind, and why? Okay, I work for a superannuation fund. I need to have an elevator pitch done to me.
Yeah. I'll take it. Cool. Obviously, Jeff, all funds can benefit from this. I think, you know, obviously you're Australian Super, so I wouldn't say this to you, but I think all funds could get value out of it. Larger funds like yourself probably have the resources to do some of this themselves if they wanted to bring it in-house. And it's probably those kind of medium to small size funds that would benefit a lot from working with actuaries to get it done, because they're unlikely to have the actuarial resources in-house. They're going to have high rates of exits to people like Australian Super or the banks, and they're the ones who can get the most bang for their buck in terms of optimizing their marketing budgets to have tailored strategies that are data-driven to benefit or stop the rate of exit.
Happy with it? He's happy with that. All right, thanks, Nathan. We'll talk some more later on, and I'll see if you can expand on that a little bit more. Look, I'll bring the session to a close. I think that's been a wonderful presentation by Nathan and by Richard. There's some terms that I hadn't quite heard before, which I'll take away. A naive estimator. I hadn't heard that one before. And confusion matrices. Well, I'm confused enough as it is without having confusion matrices. Before we bring everything to a close, can I just remind you all to fill in the feedback survey on your app. We're going to present Nathan and Richard with a bottle of wine, which I can't reach because it's right next to Richard, so I'll get you to pass it over to me. And can we thank the two in the time-honoured way?